Hello and welcome to the first episode of Gemstone Mine. We are another Magic the Gathering podcast focused on the format of Commander. I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
And today we're going to kick things off by looking at one of my personal favorite decks, Galta, a mono-green storm deck. This will be part of a Decks We Play series where I'm going to be asking my co-host for advice on cards I can add, cards I can gut, and other suggestions I can garner from them to better tune up my deck. But before we do that, we have some news we're going to talk about. So we got to play Magic for the first time in a long time recently, and we got to play that with a new website called Spelltable. So what did you guys think of the experience with Spelltable?
Spelltable was fantastic. It definitely took it was more than I expected it to be. You know, you hear about playing Magic online and then you see, you know, people with webcams hovering over their tables. You know, it plays as well as you'd expect. Spelltable completely just blew that concept out of the water with being able to track life totals in there, track whose turns it was, clicking on cards to actually pull them up and actually view what the cards do as compared to constantly having to ask. It is definitely head and shoulders above anything else that's currently out there for playing Magic online, I think, with paper cards.
Yeah, in the past, I've tried to do the webcam thing a couple times. I think John and I actually ran a couple matches from some other website. It was playable, but it certainly required a little bit of effort, and you had to juggle two or three different programs at the same time to get it all to work. Spelltable brought it all together. That was nice. They were actually originally Virtual EDH, but they've rebranded to Spelltable because, hey, it turns out you can play all kinds of Magic on here. I like the integrated card recognition thing that they've got going on. You can just click on any of the cards that show up, and it'll pop up onto the side. You can read the details. It's really, really good at recognizing the cards from what we've seen.
And you also get a good laugh every now and again if you click on someone's commander and it turns out to be just basic plans.
Yeah, that's very strange.
I mean, all told, though, the strength of that machine AI to recognize cards that quickly off of a webcam feed is really impressive. I can forgive the occasional mess up where apparently Grevin was actually a Hell of Vault all along. It's a small price to pay for the other features. I mean, there's a couple of critiques I would have of it. I would really like it if when you pass the turn in focused mode, where instead of having four different players on equal quadrants on the field, focused mode instead stacks them up on the side, and then the person you are focused on, their table, was the large one. I spent most of the game in focused mode. I found that really helpful to focus on the player whose turn it was. It would be really nice if passing the turn also kind of passed focus to the next table. I would have really appreciated that, but that's a small quibble, and I have to echo the praises that Alex and Jake are heaping on it so far.
Having the integrated life tracker, commander damage, infect, monarch, all that is built in, so you don't have to have little tokens scratched out and trying to read those. It's pretty nice. The only thing they don't have right now is voice integration. It's something that they're actively working on, but right now they suggest just using Discord, so that's what we did.
And there's no problem with using Discord. It's a great tool for a great many things.
Now, there's been some other new technology coming out recently. One of the places where you'll be able to find the deck list we're going to talk about today is on Moxfield. So, Jake, Alex, you guys were the ones who turned me on to Moxfield. So why don't you tell us about it?
So Moxfield is another of the deck building websites out there. There's, at this point, plenty of them to choose from, but it's the newest, and so far I think it is my favorite. It just feels the cleanest, the easiest to use, and I really like the both the streamlined interface that it has, and also the guy that's working on the back end of it is super friendly and very active in their own Discord. I've popped over there a couple times just to see how things were going along, or if I saw a weird feature that I wanted to get some clarification on. I went over there and saw that he was actively developing it. Like right now, they're integrating the ability to foil your cards in your deck list, and there's a nice little animation.
I will say, being able to foil out is important for certain decks of mine.
Definitely. I can think of a certain altered commander pair that comes to mind when you talk about foiling out decks. Moxfield definitely does have a lot in terms of just being clean, and also displays a ton of information that, you know, when it comes to tuning, getting decks up and ready to go, that you're looking for. So average CMC, mana curves, costs, things of that nature. And you can toggle on a lot of features as well. So if you just want a clean list of cards, you've got that option. If you want to see mana symbols next to them, you can do that. And if you actually want pricing information, we have direct links to purchase them. It has it as well. Plus, its direct link with Scryfall makes it incredibly easy to search for the cards that you need. That being said, Architect is also one that we've previously used. I know, John, that's a favorite one of yours still, and it definitely has its merits. Tell us a bit more about that one.
So Architect remains my personal preference by a slim margin. I will say Moxfield has easily taken the cake when it comes to the primer capabilities. It's inherited a lot of the good parts of Tapped Out in terms of being able to write a very good, very legible, and very organized primer, which you will see when you check out the deck list that we're going to be discussing today. I will also say the layout is extremely clean, extremely organized, and it does a very nice job of the important parts of showing the mana curve, showing spell pip breakdown, showing odds of cards appearing in your opening hands and being able to cast them. It is very, very nice in those regards. I will say the search is a little bit weaker and less forgiving than on Architect. Architect is a little bit more forgiving of typos, where if I were to misspell Eldritch Evolution and forget the T in Eldritch, which I will often do, Architect's search engine is a little bit stronger and can still pull up a card even on a misspelling and make suggestions, whereas it seems as though Moxfield is a little bit less forgiving. I'm also much more visual of a person, and I much prefer to have the option to see what I'm doing as I'm building it. Names are great, but actually being able to look at the cards and mouse over them on Architect, which currently Moxfield doesn't allow, kind of gives Architect the brewer's edge for me, whereas I think for tuning the deck, I have to give the nod to Moxfield overall.
But they are both both excellent tools, and for, you know, those of you listening to us, feel free to use whichever one makes you feel most comfortable when you're working through your decks. We're not endorsing one over the other. Moxfield just appeals to the cleanliness and streamline that Jake and I like, and John likes shiny pictures and visual aids.
I also like the ability in Architect to actually tag particular cards, since I use a staples binder for some of the more expensive cards that are in the format. I like being able to quickly identify which cards are coming into or out of a staples binder for it. I also just enjoy being able to tag cards that have been signed by an artist or altered or otherwise special or unique in that kind of way.
That is definitely a use for Architect I had not thought of. That's a good one.
It's really important to remember that my Dawn of the Dead has been signed in putrid green and black by the artist P. Ventners. Now, we were talking a moment ago about Spell Table, and that allowed us to play Commander together for the first time in a long time. So let's talk about some of the games we played yesterday. Alex, you spent most of the day trying out a new deck of yours that you only put together last week for the first time.
I did. I traditionally in the past had liked to at least have one aggro deck that I can just play. It doesn't involve a lot to it. And previously it was Edgar Markov, which has now been replaced by Winota, which is traditionally Boros aggro deck. There's not much more to say about that. What Winota can do and what kind of makes her unique is her ability that whenever a non-human creature attacks, I can look at the top six cards in my library and put a human creature card from amongst them onto the field, taps and attacking, which is a unique way for Boros to kind of take that early game advantage that, you know, Boros wants, get that early game presence, and turn sideways and try and develop that. So the game plan is pretty much to get rewarded for what it wants to do. And there were a lot of turns where, you know, I'd be swinging with a little bit of goblins and I'd be doubling damage. There'd be a giant Silverwing squadron flying in here and hitting John for like 30-something. It was a good time. But the downside to playing those games of chances is sometimes you have four or five activations where you just whiff. So, but it was definitely a lot of fun, and it's there's still some tuning to be done with it. Right now, I'm kind of leaning towards a goblins and humans theme. Got goblins early, flipping to humans. But I look forward to a lot more testing on Spell Table with you guys to kind of refine it and get it back to where I want it to be.
Yeah, it seems like once you get that balance of humans and non-humans right, the deck is going to be really consistent, because I was honestly kind of shocked just how often you got that giant 30-30 flying vigilance murder machine out on against us last week. So, yeah.
The troubling part with it is like you always got cards that you want to make sure that swinging in is always advantageous to you. And the first cards that always come to mind with that are Swords of Win the Game. So Swords of Fire and Ice, Light and Shadow, and Feast and Famine are currently in the deck, just so that when I do attack with a dorky little goblin or something of that nature, I can at least hopefully keep it alive and then reap whatever benefits may come from having the sword attached to it. But it kind of deters away from the game plan a bit of just wanting to turn sideways as often as possible and then get things on the board. So I'm kind of torn about how I want to go with that.
It did a lot better than I was honestly expecting because, it's a Boros deck. I have low opinions of Boros decks generally, but it definitely it went off a couple times and it was really cool to see that.
Definitely. And hopefully, you all might be able to see it sometime in the future on the decks we play. When it gets there, it's still a work in progress, but I think it's going to stick around for a while. It does enough things to where it can be a very direct kind of gameplay with turn things sideways, but no two games are probably going to ever end up the same way.
Jake, you had a little bit of a sadder story this week on Spell Table with Grevin and Korvald both kind of stumbling several times. Although Grevin, I believe, got an elimination this week.
Yeah, just a couple slow, rocky starts in all three of the games that we played, but, that happens. Grevin had his typical issue of killing himself a little bit quicker than the other players, but I did essentially have to kingmake in one game because I could swing at one of you guys and kill you, and then the other one would probably get me on the crackback, so that, unfortunate, but it happened. And then Korvald just did nothing, just had some bad hands, and I needed to reevaluate that deck. At one point, I had two different Korvalds at different power levels, and I tried to differentiate them as best I could, which wound up making this quite a bit weaker than I usually roll with, so I'm in the process of switching that around. I've already made 18 cuts to the deck with a pile of 22 cards I'm trying to fit in, so...
Wow, that's a lot in less than 24 hours since we got off a Spell Table.
Yeah, well, it's going back in toward the direction of semi-degenerate, but not quite degenerate.
Well, we'll have to help you put the brakes on it if we need to, or make other adjustments as we need to do so.
And then, John, you managed to showcase your ridiculous deck. Tell us about it.
Which ridiculous deck are you talking about?
The latest one. They're all ridiculous, but this is your newest one as far as I know.
So I guess you're referring to Rakdos, Lord of Riot's Scrap Trawler deck.
Yes, your typical artifact deck in black and red.
I vote we actually rename it to Rap Trawler.
It's up there. I've been thinking of it as Scrapdos, honestly. But we'll come up with a clever name for it later. So I landed on using Rakdos in a Scrap Trawler loop type deck because Rakdos's cost reduction actually saves a lot of slots in the deck. Scrap Trawler loops tend to be very dependent on getting cost reducers out to ideally get things to be free to cast and recast over and over when you're going through loops with Scrap Trawler, where Scrap Trawler is 3 generic mana for a 3/2 artifact creature, which says whenever it or another artifact you control goes to the graveyard, return another artifact from your graveyard with a lower converted mana cost to your hand. And Scrap Trawler allows for very interesting loops, using things like Hangerback Walker and Walking Ballista to gun down the table. Rakdos being able to reduce the cost of everything just by him scoring an attack often means that you can then play out a combo for free. So we got two games in with it. Deck is still not 100% where I want it to be. I'm waiting to replace a Draft Chaff common Cabal Paladin with Purphoros when the secret lair drop with Purphoros comes in the mail, which will be a little while. But overall, it kind of did what I wanted it to do. It managed to score a win without having to lean too heavily on a Scrap Trawler combo. But again, I think that's one we will save for another Decks We Play episode.
It's been a while since I've seen someone actually swing out with a Walking Ballista for damages compared to using its ability. I will say that for the deck.
It was the correct line to use.
All right, so now that we've covered games we played, we're going to get into the deck summary itself. First, Stomasaurus Rex. So what is the deck strategy you're looking for on this one, John?
So in terms of focused versus value, Galta definitely falls much more heavily on the focus side of the spectrum, With focus, decks are trying to look to get in under other decks at the table, playing threats quickly to achieve knockout blows before their opponents can stabilize the board and outvalue them. Because this is certainly a deck where if the value trains get rolling, I'm just going to get run over.
So that covers the strategy. How about where it falls into line for the five deck quadrants that we went over?
So in terms of the quadrant, this is a linear type deck. Decks in the linear quadrant are really built with liberal use of card draw, tutors, redundancy to enable a consistent game plan. And it doesn't quite cross over into optimize just by the number of spicy cards that I've had to include to make the strategy work at all. They tend to be at a very similar power level to other balanced decks. And while they can be deceptively powerful when they're first introduced, because no one really knows, well, where am I supposed to interact to stop this ungodly amalgamation of cards? Once that nut is cracked, it tends to be a deck that is vulnerable to interaction and fairly balanced at a table with other balanced decks.
Okay. Yeah, usually when somebody sits down with Galtha, you're not expecting the route you take.
And normally when you think of Storm, the first two things that don't come to mind are dinosaurs and or green. So aside from those two amazing themes, what are some of the other themes that kind of go into Stormosaurus Rex and making the deck tick?
Well, near and dear to your heart, Alex, I've included a pretty heavy elf wall package with it, where the goal is to generate large amounts of mana as early as possible off of mana dorks and elf tribal synergy. So cards like Priest of Titania, Elvish Archdruid, and even Elvish Harbinger, which also acts as a way to tutor up other important pieces in the deck. The deck has the fallback option of just classic green stompy with overstatted, undercosted creatures to overwhelm opponents by going tall and then exploiting creatures with the text box big for advantage. So cards like Ronus the Indomitable as an undercosted, overstatted fatty, as well as cards like Rishkar's Expertise and Return of the Wild Speaker to turn those overstatted stat lines into card advantage. The Stompy sub-theme is particularly important because of the commander. Galtha Primal Hunger is a 12-12 with trample for 10 and 2 green, with the special ability that Galtha Primal Hunger costs X less to cast, where X is the total power among creatures you control. This means that overstatted creatures, like Ronus, are essentially rituals towards casting Galtha. And as we mentioned, this is a Storm deck, which is specifically a Brostorm deck, which is basically Storm's weird step cousin that involves casting creatures over and over to achieve a win. And it does so by exploiting repeated draw effects like Selvala, Heart of the Wild, or Glimpse of Nature, sack out like Food Chain, and win conditions such as Aetherflux Reservoir to finish off the game.
All right, so we've got your focused, linear, green, stormy dinosaur deck. What is the early game usually like for this deck?
So as with a lot of elf ball type decks, and particularly for such a linear deck as Galtha, the deck really wants a turn one play. Ideally a turn one mana dork like Llanowar Elves or Elvish Mystic or Arbor Elf, with the goal being that by turn two, I am getting ready with three mana to be able to cast a major engine piece like Selvala, Heart of the Wild or Omnath, or something along those lines to start boosting me towards an early as possible Galtha. A lot of the deck is built towards that cast Galtha as quickly as possible, because Galtha being castable and being recastable is where the deck tries to storm off. So ideally, I want to see a hand that has at least one drop mana source. Ideally, it's an elf, but Carpet of Flowers is another favorite, and Wild Growth is kind of the next best thing, but it's also fairly good as a way to just get that additional piece of mana. Ideally, I also want to see some type of card draw or a tutor effect to get me two card draw creature engines that allow me to then go for the primary game plan.
Gotcha. And once you're there, you've had a 1, 2, 3 turns to get your mana dorks down, Gilt Selvala or Marwyn Elf Mom into play. What happens once you've got that baseline started? Once the engine starts, you know, churning and finding its pace, what happens then?
At that point, it really is about having the card draw engine online. The deck is going to be trying to go off by casting Galtha and drawing cards. So by mid-game, I want to have something like Selvala, like Beast Whisperer, which is 2 and 2 green for a elf druid that tells you whenever you cast a creature spell, you draw a card. that's the type of thing the deck wants to be doing, to just every time you cast Galta or another creature, drawing cards. Selvala is just kind of the best package of it, providing a ton of mana alongside. If we're not on the pure focused game plan, if there are faster decks than us, or we've been forced into a position where we are trying to grind out value, then I'm looking at cards like Green Bob. Oh, God, what the heck is the card's name? What's its actual name?
Okay, Adversary.
Okay, Adversary, that's the one. The 2/3 Death Touch that whenever it connects, you draw a card, while also only costing one in a green in almost every game. Although its stat line says 3 in a green, it costs 2 less if your opponent controls a green permanent, which is really common at most commander tables. We're also trying to draw to look for a way to exploit Galta for mass mana and mass card draw, which is going to kind of catapult us into the late game.
So a lot of these engines and payoffs and like every card you've mentioned so far is almost a creature. Seems like that would be pretty susceptible to getting wrathed out or wiped. How do you manage to recover from that when it does happen?
Admittedly, board wipes are a real weakness of the deck, and the deck tends to recover poorly from those. It's one of the main weaknesses that really keeps us from being a truly optimized deck. If you manage to wipe 3 or 4 dorks off the table, or God forbid, 3 or 4 dorks and a card draw engine, the deck tends to be in pretty bad shape. I have included a number of regrowth effects, which are intended to be used as essentially another copy of a mass card draw spell, where after drawing a large number of cards off of Galta with Rich Carr's expertise, if I don't hit another card draw spell, but I instead hit a regrowth, I can use the regrowth to get back my Rich Carr's expertise and continue the draw chain that way. But they also function as the backup plan of getting my engine back online in the event of a board wipe. It being a linear deck does tend to mean that it has weaknesses like this. And one of my goals is to try to steer it away from that glass cannon that these decks can turn into.
Gotcha. So say we've gone through the game so far. We've got early game, mid game, then you've survived a board wipe. All right, we're getting to the late game now. It's coming down to the final stretch of it. How do we go for that win?
Well, the most important thing to remember with this is if you're going to try a deck like this, you always start keeping track of your storm count on any turn where you feel like the win is possible, even if you don't think it's possible. Longtime competitive players would probably know that if you're doing a storm deck, you want to be ready to start making a storm count on almost any turn. And it's similar in this deck. In general, if your turn is going to open with drawing 12 cards off of Galta and you have mana to play with after that, you better be tracking your storm count. The deck will generally try to win off of Aetherflux Reservoir as just the cleanest and most mana efficient way to end the game. Drop that, cast a few other spells, get to 150 life, and just gun down the table. There are backup win cons in the deck. Having a 12-12 trampling commander is just a nice backup plan and a nice way to pressure life totals on other opponents. But it also uses some overrun effects, which are also incidentally on other good cards, like Return of the Wild Speaker, or overrun effects on Finale of Devastation, which is also a tutor, as ways to leverage having a large board with overstatted creatures to just pressure life totals and try to win that way. There are also some tertiary win conditions off of cards like Shaman of Forgotten Ways. When that's happening, there are lines for it. They're not ideal, but they certainly exist.
All right, so now that we've gone over the deck and kind of what you expect it to do in a typical game, let's draw a couple sample hands and decide whether or not they're going to be keepers, if we want to mulligan them, and kind of predict what we think the first couple turns of the game will be like and what our expectations are for that kind of game.
All right, so for this, we've set up a couple of fictional opponents to sit down with. We have randomized who will be going first in our imaginary pod as we work through this thought experiment. So going first, we will have Korvold Faith Cursed King Landfall deck, which is going to lean more on the value side of the spectrum, and it's more of a balanced deck, kind of modeled after Alex's Korvold deck. Then we have Grevin, Predator Captain, going second, which is more of a Voltron deck, which is similar to the focused linear nature of Galta. Galta will be going third in rotation. And then the last player in the pod is playing a Tatiova Benthic Druid Landfall deck, modeled after a deck that Alex had some time ago, which is kind of another value balanced type deck. So that's the pod that I'm going to be sitting down with in the number three player slot. So what opening hands do you guys have for me?
Alrighty, so the first opening hand we have is a Llanowar Elves, Beast Within, Collector Oof, Lightning Greaves, Castle Garenbrig, Forest.
So this is an interesting opening hand. Three lands is nice. I found that two lands is kind of the sweet spot that the deck wants. It has the Llanowar Elves that I really want to see in an opening hand. So it gets me to three mana right away. But it doesn't have a lot of action after that. Oof in particular is just an all-star. It, one in a green for a 2/2 that says that activated of abilities of artifacts cannot be used. In this particular pod, it's not as good. I don't see Oof having a big effect on two landfall decks, and maybe it slows Grevin down by a turn or two. And to be fair, I feel like Grevin would be the deck we'd be racing against most with this deck. But there's no card draw. There's no tutors in sight to get us to card draw. And green doesn't really have the equivalent of a Brainstorm or Ponder or Preordain to really smooth out that first draw. I would honestly mulligan this one, especially if this were my first hand.
Yeah, it looks like after your turn one play of Elves, you're essentially going to be in top deck mode pretty quickly, which is not a great place for mono green to be.
Yeah, and I mean, the haste enabler with Lightning Greaves is really nice. I will often be digging really deep to hit a haste enabler with this deck, but it's just not quite enough to get me to where I want to go. Castle Garenbrig is probably the weakest non-basic land in the deck, because while it can occasionally tap for an additional green mana, essentially, it's also not going to tap for an additional green mana for a while with this particular hand. And this deck doesn't want to be the super interactive deck where I'm trying to police the table. I would rather lean on other players to try to force them to do that.
So is the verdict here to toss it back and hope for a better seven?
I would mulligan this one, yeah.
That seems like the right choice.
All right, let's look at another hand then. This hand starts out with Llanowar Tribe, Findhorn Elves, Fauna Shaman, Priest of Titania, Beast Within, Forest, and Glimpse of Nature.
So one land hands are scary. I'm going to start out by saying that, but I kind of like this hand. It's greedy. There's no two ways about it, and it could absolutely fold if Korvold or Grevin are passing out sweepers, as we know Grevin loves his earthquake effects. But on turn two, if we had hit a land drop, if we had drawn a land off the top deck, it does allow us to have three mana on turn two to be able to cast Llanowar Tribe. It still gives us the option on turn two, even without hitting a land drop on either of those first two turns, to cast Fauna Shaman. Fauna Shaman is an all-star. Being able to put power and toughness on the field towards casting Galta, while also being a tutor to be able to throw away that Llanowar Tribe in hand to get something more efficient like Selvala, is really, really nice. We also have the option to go with the Priest of Titania off of the Findhorn Elves and Forest to start going that way. I think I would prioritize Fauna Shaman over Priest of Titania with this hand. This hand just has a lot of action. It has some very clear lines that I would be looking at to try to establish here. Again, I'll say that the interaction with Priest Within is not really what this deck is super concerned about in an opening hand, but it is still nice insurance to have. And we have the draw engine in hand with Glimpse of Nature. So if we are able to establish a decent mana base over the first three turns, being able to then cast Glimpse of Nature, try to cast a creature out of the hand, or start casting Galta, we can start to go off and generate some resources off of that. So this is a risky hand. It's definitely riskier than the ideal, but I would probably keep it.
All right. I mean, it's if it were me playing it with Elfbaum, things of that nature, I definitely would. I wouldn't give much thought to keeping this. I definitely would keep it and be greedy and see how it goes, because just the possibility of turn two Priest of Titania, turn three, pretty much cast anything I draw for that most part is kind of where we want to be with this.
Yeah, I think there's a definite debate to be had if it's Fauna Shaman first or Priest of Titania first. I think that the two top decks for turn one and turn two would really inform that. It would also definitely tell me what's going on if what Korvald and Grevin are up to so far. Titania also, if Titania is starting to run away with value, it might say, well, we got to get rid of that Rhystic Study or we're going to lose this game. So yeah, the first couple top decks and action from the other players at the table is going to inform it, but I think this one's a keeper.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of theoretical back and forth on how the first like two draws and other plays would go. I did think it was also interesting that you were leaning toward Fauna Shaman, though, over Priest. I would probably develop the mana, doubly so because there's two other green decks at the table that are probably Dork running, and Priest does count other players' elves. So I don't know. It would be a greedy keep, but I think I would probably also keep it.
All right, that brings us to our third opening hand, which consists of a Runic Armasaur, Eternal Witness, Noxious Revival, Beast Whisperer, Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx, Forest, and Forest.
So this hand lacks that turn one play that I'm always looking for, but I think it's worth considering at the very least, because this hand has a ton of value. So if we're looking at potentially racing Grevin as the fastest deck at the table, it may not be the right play, but if we're going to shift from like full focused onto more just leaning focused or trying to integrate some value into it, this hand has the value. It's going to be slower, but being able to get a turn three Runic Armasaur, turn two if we can top deck an elf on our first draw, would be really nice, particularly against two decks that are probably going to be running fetch lands almost by default. And, well, this being Jake's Grevin deck, it is going to be running the full package of fetch lands. So that could be a lot of extra card draw off of the Armasaur that the deck would really love to have. It also is nice to see Beast Whisperer in there, because that is one of the really important draw engines for the deck in general when trying to storm off. Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx, as we saw during our spell table games, it can generate an absurd amount of mana, almost more than a Gaia's Cradle on a given turn, which makes me very happy to see as well. In terms of interaction, Noxious Revival is something I'm actually kind of excited to see in my hand. Instant speed, pay two life to potentially interrupt a Life from the Loam train going off against two green landfall decks could be kind of nice. So I don't think this hand is going to be a heavily focused hand, but I could really see this hand being nice to shift more into a value line. It still gives us options and it still lets us develop our card draw, even if we're going to fall behind the mana production a bit. I would love to see a turn one mana dork off of the top deck with this. I think overall, though, I would probably at least try this hand.
All right. And for the... Alex, did you have anything you wanted to say about that deck?
John pretty much covered all of it with that one. I feel a lot in regards to making sure, like, not having that turn one play is rough. But the concept of having Runic Armor in play, especially against two decks, Korvald and Tatiova, which are probably going to be trying to leverage getting fetch lands out early, cracking them, sacrificing them, things like Korvald. There's a lot to be gained by that. So sometimes you give up that turn one play, hope that you top deck a mana dork and get that Runic Armorstone in play, and you start generating that card advantage that you want to kind of get yourself into late game. So it's definitely worth considering. I would definitely, it'd probably a keep for me as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I do enjoy the turn one plays. I would be tempted, especially if this was the first hand and you get another free seven. I might toss this one back just to try to get a little more explosiveness on the first turn, but I am reckless.
We've seen an explosive turn one, so where the games, you know, don't pan out and don't go anywhere. So you've got one great turn one, and then nothing else panned itself out for the rest of the game. You kind of sit there and just spin wheels and tread water, having an engine already in the hand with the possibility of guaranteed turn three, possibly turn two, does make it seem like it'd be worth a keep, or at least worth a consideration.
I'm feeling very targeted by that comment, so we're going to move on to hand four.
That was definitely aimed more towards yesterday during the Winota game, where it was turn one, mountain, mana crypt, arcane signet, nothing for the rest of the game. So, awesome turn one. Nah, not as much turns two through death.
All right, get out of here, Winota. This is Stormosaurus Rex time. Hand four. We've got Joraga Tree Speaker, Worldly Tutor, Forest, Rishkar Pima Renegade, Finale of Devastation, Boreal Druid, and Sol Ring.
Yeah, this is pretty close to a Windmill Slam Keep, but there are some issues with it. Like other previous hands that we looked at, and like the deck in general, it's really weak to sweepers. In general, a one land hand, I am generally okay with keeping. Two is, again, the sweep spot, but if we were to top deck a land with our first draw, I think turn one we go Joraga Tree Speaker, with the goal that on turn two we're going to go into Sol Ring plus Rishkar or Sol Ring plus Boreal Druid. The first play gets us 5 power and 7 mana on turn three, which that means we can cast Galta, because Galta would cost 2 green and 5. On the other hand, it also gives us the option to cast Finale of Devastation for X equals 3 to get Silvala on turn 3 for a really comfy turn 4 Galta. On the other hand, if we don't top deck a land on turn 1, I'm probably going to say turn 1 Boreal Druid, and then turn 2 Sol Ring plus Rishkar. This gives 3 green mana on turn 2, plus 2 colorless mana to begin our game plan on turn 3, even if we don't hit a land for 3 draws. There is not really any interaction in this hand. In general, that's okay. But Grevin is the serious contender at the table to be able to race us. And this hand is really telling us to lean focused and just go for it. The couple first top decks and whether or not we hit a second land is kind of the critical deciding factor here. Having both a Finale of Devastation and a Worldly Tutor in hand, it gives us a lot of options.
Definitely. It does seem like the near perfect hand, and the only thing that I would change about it would be to swap out Boreal Druid for like a Land Wilds or an Elvish Mystic. But other than that, I don't think there's much I'd want to actually change with how this can pan out. You've got multiple lines of play for turn one through turn three, and it's exactly where this deck wants to be. So you can develop mana advantage early on, or you can develop card advantage early on. It's entirely based off of the plays that the other players at the table are making, but you have those options, which is where this deck wants to be, I think.
Couldn't say it better myself.
All right, guys, you've seen my rough outline of the deck. I've talked about the early game, the mid game, the late game. I talked about the strategies, the themes, the power level. We've gone through some opening hands, so help me out here. How do I continue to iterate on this deck? How do I improve?
So some of the cards I thought that might be a good additions to it were kind of just ways to take what's already existing and shore it up just a bit more to make them a bit more solidified if we get to those points in the game where they'd be valid. So if we're looking towards the end game to go ahead and swing out for that win, or just to get power on the board so that Galta's cheaper and comes in, or that Marwyn generates more mana, or just to trigger an additional card draw for Silvala, we of course have Craterhoof Behemoth, the undisputed king of green decks, for lack of better words. For the most part, whenever Hoof comes down, it means the end of the game in some capacity. In Silvala, it means that not simply in terms of swinging out, but sometimes this gives you that larger power total to make, like I said, Marwyn tap for more mana to get more spells out there, make Galta cheaper to come down to be sacrificed where normally she wouldn't be able to because of the mana restrictions put in place by the current board state. For looking at the opposite end of the spectrum, so if we're looking for Critter for the late game, we have Incubation Druid, which I think would be a good addition early game. So what that would do is give you another 2-drop mana dork, which is not always where we want to be, but it does have the advantage of being able to adapt it, essentially making it tap for more on par with the Lanimar tribe, as well as actually giving it a boost in power as well. So you'll be able to get it down early. And then as the game goes on, if you've got a lull here, a lull there, have extra mana to spend, you can boost Incubation Druid up, and then it taps for more mana, and then we'll make it so that Galta has that little bit of extra power to kind of lean into. You did touch on Fauna Shaman as being one of the all-stars of the deck to get down early. And if one effect like that is good, why not a second one? So Survival of the Fittest definitely makes my shortlist for additions to the deck. For the most part, when running in most tables, enchantment removal is one of the lesser forms of removals that you come across. Normally, it's creature artifact. And Survival of the Fittest, definitely strong effect. Having one Fauna Shaman is good. Having a second one that's a bit harder to remove is, you know, excellent. One of my personal favorites, Season of Growth. Surprisingly,
I'm not familiar with Season of Growth.
So Season of Growth is one of my favorite cards to recently grace us in Magic. And it is 2 mana, 1 and a green. And whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control, you may scry one. Nothing super crazy. But if you've got a lot of creatures constantly coming down, it gives you the ability to kind of look through the top of your deck, see if it's a card you want, and then put it to the bottom. From having played against your deck many times, I've seen where, you know, you'll draw a handful of cards and not hit what you need. So by taking advantage of all these cards coming in, you can thin the top of your deck to make sure that when you do hit one of your mass draw spells, that you're ensuring one of the cards you need is in there. And then one of its lesser known abilities, or lesser use, I should say, is whenever you cast a spell that targets creature control, draw a card. While not as prevalent, it still gets you a card draw, but mainly the reason for its inclusion is just with as many times as creatures come into play, especially if you're utilizing things like Team or Sabertooth and of that nature, it definitely lets you see more of your deck, which is something that green sorely needs. And the final addition on mine is Orin Frostfang, which is a relatively new card. But it does a lot to kind of shore up and give a bit more power endgame to what the dorks themselves can do. Orin Frostfang is a five drop, 3 and 2 green for a 2/6, attacking creatures you control have death touch. So it makes your little dorks that if you ever need to swing out and try and generate a board advantage, makes them threatening to even the largest of creatures. So pretty much the only thing you really need to worry about is double strike, first strike, or indestructible creatures. Other than that, your dorks can take down pretty much anything they would come across. And the reason that is kind of relevant here is the second part of Orin Frostfang that reads, whenever a creature you control deals combat damage to a player, draw a card. So at present, your card draw is based off of simply drawing the cards that allow you to draw more cards. With this, it kind of gives you the avenue. You generate mana early enough in the game to where having 5 mana on, say, turn 2 or turn 3 or turn 4 isn't that unheard of. And if you get there before some of the players can, say Grevin has only had a chance to play some mana rocks, nothing else has happened, Corvold is still lining up, Tatiova is still putting lands into play, there's a chance you can swing out with those little mana dorks that you have and pick up an extra card or two, just giving yourself that little bit of incremental value off the front of it. And it blocks Timna.
Little bit less relevant at the level that I'm aiming for with the deck, but certainly some interesting inclusions.
I felt it was worth noting.
That is always something that we are worried about. So it looks like a lot of the cards...
We have to get our meme count in.
Yeah, that's true. So it looks like some of the cards that you're suggesting are pushing more towards the value end of the spectrum to try and tune Galta away from that heavily focused type of build, which in all honesty, the deck may kind of need. My original iteration of the deck was to try to see, can I make a CDH deck out of Galta? The answer is no, just full no. It was a very fun experiment and led to one of my all-time favorite decks, but it certainly is not to that hyper-focused level of optimized that a CEDH deck can reach. So maybe leaning a little bit more value may benefit the deck overall and give it a little bit more game against decks that are trying to push towards the late game.
Well, I've got a couple cards to also suggest that would put it right back in that focus category for the most part. So we'll go ahead and start. My first proposed inclusion is Hyrax Tower Scout. It's a newer card. What's up?
So what does that one do?
Yeah, it's a 3/3 for 2 generic and a green. And when it enters the battlefield, you untap target creature.
So another untapper type effect.
Yeah, just yet another untapper. You're already running a couple. This one's not as cheap as some of the others, but it is a creature, so you can tutor for it easier to get some extra value out of your Savala or any other strong effect that you've got out.
The only thing wrong with it is not an elf.
Yeah.
That is true.
I mean, not everything can be a perfect elf, but that's not a bad idea. Another untapper is nice. Being able to chain Vitalize and Great Oak Guardian have been very nice for the deck. Scrib Rangers and Querion Scout are both amazing. Querion Ranger, excuse me, are both amazing to be able to untap a giant mana producer like Priest of Titania or Savala or Marwyn. That one's potentially really nice, actually.
And another similar line would be the Karametra's Acolyte. It's three generic and a green for a 1/4 human druid. You tap and add green to your mana pool equal to your devotion to green. So it would just be another of your large mana producers, potentially another thing to target with your untappers. And you are running Nykthos already, which is just another devotion-centric green mana producer. So this would just be doubling up on that effect.
Okay, okay.
And the last three proposed cards are actually all lands. One is Ancient Tomb. Tap for two colorless. It deals 2 damage to you. Galta is a fast deck that is trying to apply the pressure and go off pretty quickly. So the 2 damage and a 40 life format isn't a huge deal. It doesn't produce green, and a lot of your cards do require green, but not all of them do. I mean, it's why you're running Soul Ring, etc. So I just think that any land that can produce more than one mana is worth looking at.
That is why I have Castle Garenbrig in there, because it does produce the extra green occasionally. I had thought about Ancient Tomb. I had held off on it for just a little while because colorless mana usually isn't where I'm getting stuck, but maybe it is something I look at.
Another card, this one's a little spicier, perhaps, is Emergence Zone. It is a land from War of the Spark. It taps for a colorless. And you can also pay one, tap, and sack it to cast spells this turn as though they had flash. Not perhaps the most required card in the deck, but it would allow you to go off at instant speed using your Aether Flux Reservoir, even on somebody else's turn, sneaking it out to take advantage of, I guess that's more of spells you've cast. So this may not be a great card included after all.
Well, it's always neat to look at cards like that, though.
All right, let me recover from that and suggest Gemstone Caverns. It is a legendary land. If it's in your opening hand and you're not playing first, you can put it into play with a luck counter. If you do, you have to remove a card in your hand from the game. And as a land, you can tap it for a colorless, but if it has a luck counter on it, you can tap it for any colored mana. So basically, it's like a Chrome Mox that only works if you are not going first and it is in your opening hand. So yes, it has lots of limitations, but it is a card that can produce green mana. It can help you go off faster. And that is just another way of bumping the speed of this deck up a little bit.
So that's a lot of interesting cards to suggest adding. I need to kind of weigh the pluses and minuses of them. Karametra's Acolyte was actually in one of the original versions of the deck. And at that time, I thought it was a little bit too slow for a 4-mana mana dork to be able to then... Yeah, it produces a ton of mana. But usually by the time I had 4 mana on the field, I was probably looking to try to cast Galta. It's certainly worth going back and looking at again. Incubation Druid, I also had cut previously. When it first came out, I looked at it as a possible include, but I think I kind of disregarded it right away, seeing that it had 0 power, which meant it was actually a mana negative play towards getting Galta out. But if the deck does hew a little bit closer to value, being able to then invest 5 mana to get 3 power on it, and 3 mana out of it means that for a net 7 mana, we're getting 6 cost off of Galta, which is not bad at all. And it also makes it more mana positive with untappers, which is really, really nice. Survival of the Fittest, I've actually has come in and out of the deck a few times. It has sometimes been Survival of the Fittest. It has sometimes been Incubation Druid. Incubation Druid needing a turn to lose Summoning Sickness, that is a downside to it. But having power towards Galta is also nice. I think Survival does need to go back in, Alex. I think you're right there. And Craterhoof, getting hoofed is a, as you said, it's a surefire way to end the game. And I would not mind having another overrun effect as a backup plan. But the question then is, with all these really nice recommendations you guys are making, what do I cut from the deck?
We get to the hard part. So the first on my list of the chopping block is Goreclaw, Terror of Khalsisma. Goreclaw is a 4-mana creature, 3 generic and 1 green, 4/3. It says creature spells you cast with power 4 greater cost 2 less to cast. And whenever Goreclaw Terror Kill System attacks, each creature you control with power 4 greater gets +1/+1 and gains trample 10 a turn. Powerful card, and I've definitely seen it do work in other decks before. It seemed a little out of place with this one. It does make Galt a bit cheaper, but it doesn't really do too much for the rest of your deck. So it comes down, makes Galt a bit cheaper, both in its cost reduction and the fact that it has 4 power, essentially getting you to negative 6 mana for Galt. But the problem with that is if you draw it, Galt is already in play, or, you know, it just feels like it leaves a lot to be desired and isn't always the card you want to see.
Yeah, I think you're right. Goreclaw was a card that really intrigued me when it first came out. It still is pretty intriguing, and it's still a neat card. But I do have to agree, I never find myself tutoring for it. I'm not always happy when I see it off the top deck during a turn when I am trying to draw towards a win. Yeah, I can see Goreclaw, Big Angry Bear, being a pretty good cut.
So my next one is gonna get a reaction out of Jake, I think. I actually think Food Chain also doesn't really feel like it fits here. It's
blasphemy.
I get it. But it's 3 mana to get down, and you exile a creature you control, you know, add X mana of any one color where X is the plus the creature's converted mana cost, and spend to cast creature spells. But for the most part, I mean, it only does something, it really comes into play once you've got one of your big fatties down. So if you have that in an opening hand, or you draw that in the first 2 or 3 turns of the game, are you sacking a land warrior for 2 mana? It definitely has strong suit, and Food Chain is absolutely stellar in the decks that can absolutely abuse Food Chain. This just doesn't seem
like... this deck can absolutely abuse Food Chain. Where do you think I sacrifice Galt to?
You can sacrifice Galt to...
I get 13 green mana off of Food Chain, and then Galt is going to cost me 2 to recast. So, yeah, I love Food Chain in this deck.
Chain as a fair card. I think Food Chain works best when you are breaking the rules of Magic.
Yeah. Like, when you sacrifice something
to it... This is hard to hear.
Like, you sacrifice something to it, like a Mistholo Griffin, and then Mistholo Griffin comes back, because it loves you that much. And then you just keep doing it. And then Wargalta can get you 13 mana, technically 10 mana if you count the 3 to cast Food Chain if it comes down the same turn, where that is fair Magic, but it's not broken Magic.
It could be broken. You can absolutely recast Galt off of that multiple times. If you've got a draw engine out, yes, at that point it is a 2-card combo plus your commander, but you can easily use Food Chain as a win condition with a deck.
It is definitely...
I know it's not broken Food Chain combo, but it is still a good Food Chain.
It's definitely the last card on the list to be cut, so it'd be the last one in my opinion. But it does seem just a smidge out of place. But in all fairness, it could be because I'm used to seeing Food Chain as a broken card and not as a fair value card. The next one for me is Omnath, Locus of Mana, which, in all fairness, having described how you'd use Food Chain makes a bit more sense it being in there. My only concern is that, you know, you resolve Omnath relatively early. You start putting mana into it, it gets a bit larger, and then it gets removed, and you've pretty much invested so much into Omnath, and then there's nothing to essentially show for. That being said, if it comes down towards late game, and you use it to sit there and, you know, Food Chain out Galt, cast Galt for free, throw mana into Omnath, I can see how that would work, as you make a giant Omnath, sacrifice it to one of your spells that allow you to draw cards equal to power, and you draw a decent amount. So I can see that line now where I previously did not.
The other thing that's important to know with Omnath is that Omnath is absurdly good at enabling a Galt cast. If I can get Omnath on the field, it can pretty much guarantee that Galt will come down next turn if Omnath stays on the field. So let's call a judge. An interesting thing about the way you cast spells in Magic is that first thing you do is you lock in the price after you choose all your modes and select your cost for X and all those things. So when you're casting Galt, first you're going to lock in Galt's price. And among that, you're going to look at the power and toughness of Omnath. So say you have the ability to produce 5 mana and no other creatures on the field. You tap 5 forests, you have 5 green mana floating. Omnath is currently a 6/6. That means that Galta's cost is going to be reduced by 6. Maybe I should have been smarter and said there were 6 forests there, which would have get Galta's cost down to 7 minus 2 is 5. But you understand what I mean. You lock in Galta's cost based on Omnath's power and toughness, and then you spend mana from your mana pool that shrinks Omnath after you have locked in the cost of Galta. So Omnath is absurdly good at enabling a Galta cast and absurdly good at enabling future Galta casts on subsequent turns, even from kind of a weak board position.
But its primary focus is essentially there to just enable Galta casts. Does it have any, aside from just value outside of enabling Galta casts, its only other purpose is to be able to store mana through phases and become a beater?
It's a battery for mana. It can potentially be a beater. It is a backup plan for Selvala to tap for a bunch of mana. It is a backup plan for being able to draw a ludicrous number of cards off of spells like Rishkar's Expertise. It is essentially my backup Galta, and I don't know about this cut either, but I can see the argument, but it is my second most common tutor fetch after Selvala.
Gotcha. All right, and next one on my list is Shaman of the Forgotten Ways. So this one also might be a bit of a controversial one because it does have its unique biorhythm alternate ability, which it's always nice. So Shaman of the Forgotten Ways is a 3-mana, 2 generic, 1 green, 2/3 human shaman that when you tap it, adds 2 mana of any one color combination to your mana pool. It can only be spent on creatures. And its second ability, which is Formidable, which means you can only activate this ability if you control total 8 power or greater amongst creatures you control, is 11 mana. Tap, each player's life total becomes the number of creatures he or she controls. So it's definitely a good way to kind of sneak that in there and chip a lot away from some life total or, you know, possibly kill a player if they have no creatures in play. But it seems like a lot for a big ask to just have an additional way to kind of kill somebody without combat damage, which you already have in the way of Aetherflux Reservoir and things of that nature. It just seems that it may not always be what you want to cast on turn 3. Or turn 2.
Jake, I think this appeared on your list of potential cuts as well.
Yeah, I've also got it on there as a maybe cut. My reason was mostly that the mana produced by it is restricted only for creatures, which, I mean, this is a very creature-heavy deck, so that's not a horrible problem. But as is, the current deck list is 32 creatures with your and 33 including your commander. So it's 1/3 of the deck. That means there's 2/3 of the deck you can't cast, although another third is land. I don't know. I was kind of iffy on this, but it's probably the weakest of the dorks, I would guess, due to the fact that it costs 3 and produces restricted mana.
It is probably the weakest of the dorks. You're right with that. So far, the main reason it's earned its keep is that it is still kind of mana positive. You spend 3 mana to cast it. Galta's cost reduction ability sees 2 power on the field, and it taps to produce 2, so those 3 mana essentially turn into 4 mana towards Galta. The Biorhythm backup plan is also a way that I have definitely ended games. I would certainly cut this before Food Chain and before Omnath, but I would cut Goreclaw way before I cut Shaman. Still, this is a good suggestion, and if I am trying to remove extra win conditions that I don't really need and upgrade mana dorks, Shaman does have to get a serious looking at. I think you're right about that one.
Gotcha. Next on my list is Voice of Many, which is a weird one for me, given my love of elves and my love of card draw. Voice of Many is a 3/3 elf for 4, 2 generic and 2 green. When voice mentions the battlefield, draw a card for each opponent who controls fewer creatures than you. Appealing ability on a creature. It has relatively high cost for something that could be hit or miss, depending on when you draw it. So that's just my whole thing with that. Like, 4 mana is kind of a big ask to maybe draw a card. It does have the upside of being 3 power, which does reduce Galta a bit. So there is that to be said for it.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Voice of Many was a recent add to the deck as I was trying to find ways to improve the card draw of the deck while also cutting some of the higher end stuff out of the deck to make the deck a little bit leaner. It came in after dropping the 6 mana draw engines like Primordial Sage and Soul of the Harvest, both of which were drawing cards off of creature casts. So while those were nice, they were still 6 mana and little painful to get off. So at that time, my reasoning was, let me reduce the cost. Let me just have a harmonize that also reduces the cost of Galta. But it's an experiment, and I'm not sure if the experiment's worked out.
Gotcha. And the last one on my list is Woodland Bellower. So Woodland Bellower is a 6/5 for 6, 4 generic and 2 green. When Woodland Bellower enters the battlefield, you may search the library for a non-legendary green creature card with converted mana cost 3 or less. Put onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. I've seen decks where Woodland Bellower does works. Prime Speaker Vanifars and Yasona are the two that come to mind for that because of the use of untappers. If you were to add things like Hierarch's Tower Scout in, it definitely would kind of maybe merit a cut, as you could just go get Hierarch's Tower Scout, goes into play, untaps Selvahl or something of that nature, and you kind of keep on going. But other than that, it looks like the through drops for the most part that you're after are legendary creatures, which is kind of a drawback. But if this could let you get any 3-drop, like Marwyn or Savala, then it would absolutely earn its keep.
Yeah, I think you're right about that one, too. This is one that it's been getting a lot of long, hard looks for me. I wasn't sure if the correct cut was the Primordial Sage or Woodland Bellower in the most recent round of cuts. I kept Woodland Bellower just as the ability to go get some additional value. I think its most common target is usually Elvis Archdruid, which is for an extra green mana over Priest of Titania, so 1/2 green, you get a 2/2 elf lord that gives all their elves +1/+1, and then taps for 1 green mana for each elf you control. So it did a lot of the same role of Priest of Titania, while also providing a massive boost in power on the board towards casting Galta. I don't know if the Woodland Bellower is worth it just to get that. Yeah, this is another one I think that it would be probably a pretty easy cut.
So I've got a couple suggestions as well. The first one is Elvish Harbinger. I have this on the potential cut block because it's a 3-mana top of library tutor only for an elf. It is a mana dork. It's a 3-mana mana dork that makes 1 mana and also can grab an elf and put it on the top of your library. I just think that both of those effects are kind of weak for the 3-cost body, and even putting them together, it may not be worthwhile for the slot.
I can see where you're getting at. This was probably my digging deepest for ways to get Selvahla. So peek behind the curtains, this deck is heavily based on the CDH Selvahla Brostorm list, which is where part of the theme of the deck got its name. But Selvahla being in the command zone is a significant advantage over Galta being in the command zone. So I dug deep to find ways to find Selvahla and get her out as consistently as possible. Elvish Harbinger is definitely the weakest of the effects. Cards like Finale of Devastation and another recent spicy add that I've really enjoyed, Time of Need, have sort of made Elvish Harbinger a little bit more iffy. Yeah, I think this one can pretty easily go on the cutting block.
We've already touched on Shaman of Forgotten Ways, which was on my list. Another one is Beast Within. Now, I know this is a very popular card, but you did touch on this a little bit in the Mulligans. Your deck is not normally trying to fill the policing role at the table, and this is a 3-mana interaction card, which is kind of high when normally you would want to be the one asking the questions, presenting the threats, and making other people deal with it. Green has some other removal. You've got like Nature's Claim in here. That's only 1 mana, and it gets rid of an artifact or enchantment. It's less global because you can't hit any permanent, but the fact that Beast Within is 3 mana, I think, is a pretty big downside for it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. It's still nice to have something in the deck where I know that if I draw enough, I can get rid of Alex's Banisher Priest that is holding me in check at the moment, or get rid of the Rule of Law effect that is dominating the board at the moment, or turn off the Cursed Totem, that if I can just draw enough cards, I still have a chance in the game. I can see where you're coming from with it. I think at the power level that I'm aiming for with the deck, aiming for more of a linear deck than an optimized deck, kind of want to lean towards keeping it in, but I can see the argument for trading it out for something cheaper as well.
Yeah, that's fair. And I guess if I had to propose a different card than my poorly thought out Emergent Zone, I'd do like Force of what's the green force? Force of Vigor?
Force of Vigor.
As filling in, like, as a cheaper potential removal.
That's true.
Okay, so the next card is Ronus's Monument, and you could probably just replay what I said for Beast Within or Elvish Harbinger, because this is a 3-mana card that has an effect that you like, but I don't know if it's enough of an effect. The cost reduction is just 1 generic on your green creatures. You do have a decent number of cards that do not have generic in their cost. Either they're just a single green or triple green, like Llanowar Tribe. And it doesn't have any power, so it's not going to contribute to Galta. The granting trample, how often does that actually come up?
It is one of the tertiary win cons of the deck. So Ronus's Monument being able to grant +2/+2 and trample is surprisingly clutch, because the +2/+2 covers the commander tax for recasting Galta. So it does allow Food Chain Loops to go infinite with Galta. It does allow Salvala Loops to go infinite with Galta. And it is its own win condition, even if I lose my Aetherflux Reservoir, even if I can't get to a Finale of Devastation. It has absolutely ended games where I can just spread around that +2/+2 and trample to my board and run people over. I certainly agree that not having power on the front end is not really what I want to be doing. I want to have the additional power, but it's kind of proven itself a few times.
Okay, that's fair. I haven't actually seen it in action yet, and I didn't catch all of those interactions that it has. So, yeah, I can see that justifying its slot. All right.
So I got some hard truths to look at with the deck. I need to decide if I lean a little bit more towards the value end, maybe just wind up with a deck that's leaning focused, as some of Alex's suggestions would make, or if I want to go harder into the focused end of the spectrum, cut down costs, and really narrow in on what the deck is trying to do, as Jake's been suggesting. Am I willing to have fewer options? Do I lose the flexibility of Beast Within for the cheapness of a card like Force of Vigor? That would be really nice to see happen. Oh, this is going to be, you guys are giving me a lot of stuff to think about.
That's what we're here for, to guide you in one of two directions, either to go more linear or to go more value.
Yeah, so thank you guys. I've got a lot of work to do, and I can't wait to do this for other decks in the future.
This was a nice deep dive on weird little homebrew deck that I enjoyed. I've seen it in action a couple times, but this gave me a peek into how it was created and why some of the interesting choices are there. So I liked it.
The spicy choices.
The right choices.
All right. So we hope you guys have enjoyed this as well. We hope you'll join us next time for another episode of Gemstone Mine. So until next time, I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG, or you can send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.